This episode of Haunted Places contains particularly disturbing and sensitive material, including discussion of torture, slavery, and suicide. Caution is advised, particularly for listeners under age 13. A pale, clear moon casts light on the heads and shoulders of dozens of revelers trawling the French Quarter. Hurricanes in hand, their heels clicked a staccato rhythm on the cobblestones, adding their own percussive signature to the brassy New Orleans jazz spilling out of the nightclubs. Inside 1140 Royal Street, however, Jamie couldn't hear any of it. The sounds of joy outside became fainter the further they intruded into the house, swallowed by thick oak doors and heavy damask curtains. Jamie, a friend of the mansion's latest owners, had volunteered to help with their move. The owners were doctors, and if truth be told, incorrigible history buffs. Jamie's night had been spent packing the doctor's collection of antique medical texts and journals. The scent of cigar smoke surprised her. The doctors didn't smoke. And she thought she was the last friend left, finishing up the room she'd committed to. But she noticed a light in a room down the hall and rose to investigate. In the sitting room, standing behind the doctor's prized antique walnut bar cart, Jamie saw a tall man in an old-fashioned evening coat. The man was puffing what looked like a hand-rolled cigar while pouring himself a drink. Jamie called out to him, but the man ignored her. Jamie always had a bit of a short fuse. It was one of her weaknesses. And being ignored made her furious. Angrily, Jamie crossed the room and shoved the wheeled bar aside. Jamie had planned to snatch the cigar right out of the man's mouth. But what she saw made her stop short. As the bar rolled away, revealing the man's waist, she was horrified to realize there were no legs or feet beneath it. The smoking man's body ended in a sort of wispy haze, fading impossibly into the patterned wallpaper behind him. The man met her gaze and winked. Welcome to Haunted Places on the Parcast Network. I'm Greg Polson. Every Thursday, I take you to the scariest, eeriest, most haunted, real places on Earth. This week, join me on a deep, dark journey to the LaLaurie Mansion, where some of the most brutal and shameful acts in history occurred. Some call it the most haunted house in America. Some call its mistress the most prolific female serial killer of all time. To this day, it's haunted. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. Listen to more episodes of Haunted Places, as well as Parcast's other podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. The LaLaurie Mansion takes its name from its most famous residence, Marie Delphine McCarty LaLaurie, and her third husband, Dr. Leonard LaLaurie. First married at age 14, Madame Delphine LaLaurie was twice a widow, and a mother to 5 children by the time she married Dr. LaLaurie in 1825. Made vastly wealthy by her previous husband's untimely ends, Delphine quickly established herself and Leonard as part of the elite of New Orleans' moneyed society. In 1831, Delphine used her wealth to buy the unfinished mansion at 1140 Royal Street in the French Quarter of New Orleans. She and her family moved into the square gray mansion in 1832. Delphine threw herself into decorating the home, with no expense spared. Every piece of artwork, every item of furniture, had to be of the highest quality. Soon, the LaLaurie Mansion was born, and on its way to being infamous. Inside, tucked away from the street, the mansion was not a home, but a torture chamber. There was only one way for those enslaved to escape Madame LaLaurie. They said no one had been looking up when the man fell from the third story of the LaLaurie Mansion. Apparently, no one outside could say if he jumped or was pushed. But Leah heard the yelps in a tone she knew much too well for her 12 years of age. The man had made a mistake, and the madam had no tolerance for mistakes. Mistakes were punished, bones broken and reset at ersatz angles, mouths filled with excrement and then sewn up, bodies caged like birds, forced to watch other servants tortured to death. It did not do to displease Madame Delphine. That was what the madam told them, a warning as the enslaved women drew warm baths to wash away the blood of their companions. As for her husband, he could not care less, content to smoke his cigars while his wife was occupied. Outside, they shouted for a doctor and gossiped like schoolgirls. Inside, they prayed to God and whispered in fear. From the slaves' quarters to the parlor was much talk of the man who threw himself out the window on the third floor, dashing his brains out on Royal Street. Some said he committed suicide. The LaLaurie said he had an accident. Leah said, quietly to herself at night, he was free. But the LaLauries told their version loudest. Leah's masters were always having parties, acting as if theirs was a peaceful home, to show how committed they were to the safety of those they enslaved. They cemented over the window the man had fallen from, as if there weren't 10 other street-facing windows on that same floor. When called into the dressing room, Leah did as she was told. She picked up the boar bristle brush and began to brush her mistress's hair, extra gently. Madame Delphine was quiet and calm now. Leah knew this afternoon she should be safe. She returned to her quiet thoughts of a man flying free. She continued brushing the woman's silky, stick-straight hair. She was nearly done when she pulled an unexpected snarl. The madam's head jerked backward. Delphine yelped in the same tone as the man who jumped out the window. Leah was already running. She rounded the corner, praying she could put distance between herself and the whip Madame Delphine kept on the table. She ran past Dr. LaLaurie, who blew a smoke ring as if to hide Leah from his vision. Leah fled to the nearest window, intending to climb out. She pushed it, but it was stuck. She ran farther, past the cemented window and onto another. She tried to fling it open, but it was lodged shut. Stuck. The next window, also stuck. The madam, closer and closer. The windows, stuck. Leah, feet from a whip. A window, stuck. Leah abandoned the windows and ran upstairs. She wouldn't allow the madam to cage her. Leah turned right and headed to the roof. Barreling outside, Leah was faced with a choice. Behind her was Madame Delphine, raging and snapping her long whip, swearing to beat her senseless. In front of her was a four-story drop. Leah chose to be free. In 1833, witnesses saw Delphine attempting to bury Leah's mangled body in a shallow grave in the corner of her property. This time, at least, it looked like the slave who lost their life might have some justice. The police, notified by neighbors, fined Delphine $300 as punishment and made her sell her 9 slaves. The police failed, however, to prevent LaLaurie from enlisting her relatives to buy the slaves back for her. There was no justice for Leah, or the unknown man who jumped before her. Leah wasn't content with the pitiful attempt at justice she received, and she would make her displeasure known. Her ghost haunts the mansion to this day, a little girl beckoning visitors to the rooftop, to freedom. But she's not alone. Coming up, another spirit trapped in the mansion by Madame LaLaurie. Now, back to the story. The LaLaurie Mansion was a house of horrors, a torture chamber, and tomb. Madame LaLaurie was a sadist. Dr. LaLaurie simply didn't care. And New Orleans high society preferred to close their eyes and have another glass of free champagne. In the 1830s, an invitation to a party at the LaLaurie Mansion was the hottest ticket in town. A woman with varied and dark tastes, Madame LaLaurie rubbed elbows some nights with princes and ambassadors, and others with the likes of Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans. We can't fully confirm the two ever met, but legend holds the pair made a deal with the devil. After 6 girls, it was only natural to hire Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans, to ensure the next child would be a boy. The young parents, Camille and Louis Matthews, breathed sighs of relief when Marie Laveau agreed to perform the rituals to ensure a male heir. But Marie knew more than she let on about Louis and Camille. When Louis asked her to provide him with a son, she had to keep a smirk from her face. One didn't earn the title Voodoo Queen without knowing everything that went on in her city. Even what went on in the tiniest, dingiest sharecropper shacks on the plantations lining the Mississippi River. For example, the shack on the Matthews plantation where 2-year-old Maurice lived. His brothers and sisters were polite, refraining from commenting on how little Maurice was oddly light-skinned. And they refrained from spreading the word that after drinking, Louis would often appear at the door of the shack where little Maurice lived. And Camille, ever soft-hearted, would frequently stop by with toys or clothing for the boy. Marie Laveau didn't take kindly to liars and secret keepers. The voodoo queen could have made a living zombie of Louis with a single potion. And here he was, asking for a male heir, when there was a male child with his eyes, living just on the edge of his property. Marie would give Louis an heir, all right, a son as he had requested, and she would let him live to regret it. She kept her face grim as her snake slid over Camille's body, wriggling under clothes and in her hair. Louis was properly scared. The snake wasn't poisonous, but he didn't need to know that. When the ritual was complete, Marie left a terrified Louis to inspect his wife for snake bites. She'd be in danger if she were to start bleeding, Marie warned him. Nine months later, she was called to their home again to help bring forward the male heir Louis deserved. When Marie arrived, Camille's water had already broken. Camille labored long with her son. Marie tended to her with care, wiping her brow with a wet rag soaked in a potent concoction of herbs. Finally, after far too many hours of labor, the baby emerged in a pool of blood. Marie wiped it out of the infant's mouth while his ignorant father exclaimed with joy, "I have a son!" Camille continued to bleed through the night, soaking through all the towels placed under her pelvis. A doctor was called. He fought to save her hemorrhaging body until the small hours of the morning. As the blood-red sun rose over the delta, Camille took her last breaths. Marie Laveau did what she could to make the young mother's exit from the mortal world painless. Camille wasn't blameless in her husband's dishonesty, but neither was she the voodoo queen's enemy. That designation was reserved for the liar Louis, whose torments would be far greater. Louis's nightmare began that very morning, when he finally turned his attention from his dying wife to his newborn son. In the dawn light, Louis saw his son's face clearly for the first time. The rusty tint of his skin, the tufts of fur on his body, the two bumps on his skull, tiny horns coming to needle-sharp points, like two fangs from a snake. Now, Louis knew why Camille couldn't stop bleeding. Refusing to even look at the boy, Louis ordered a servant to pack the baby in a bassinet and give him to the voodoo queen. His parting words to Marie Laveau were, "I don't care what you do with that devil child, so long as I never see him again." Those were the last lucid words Louis ever spoke. Driven mad by grief and raving about how his newborn son was evil incarnate, he was quickly committed to a sanatorium in New Orleans, exactly as Marie had planned. She knew exactly who would want the baby. Marie walked from Louis's plantation, baby on her hip, all the way to the foreboding LaLaurie mansion in the French Quarter. Madame LaLaurie and Marie Laveau had an uneasy relationship. Two such strong personalities were a poor fit as friends. But on the spring day, when Marie Laveau appeared at the LaLaurie mansion with the orphan baby, Madame Delphine LaLaurie was delighted to receive her. Madame LaLaurie had been experimenting with a little voodoo of her own. Raising this child was the natural next step. The two women agreed to share responsibility. Marie Laveau would formally adopt the boy, but Madame LaLaurie would keep him and nurse him at her breast. The baby's presence in the opulent LaLaurie mansion was an open secret. Any servant who dared to mention his unholy appearance was swiftly dealt with, and any neighbor who gossiped about the child lost their coveted place in the LaLaurie's social circle. Nevertheless, rumors spread around New Orleans that the two women were using the child in rituals to summon Satan himself. And as the child grew, his screams, like nothing ever heard from an earthly infant, got louder and louder, eventually becoming enough to set every dog in the French Quarter to howling each night. The screams infected both women's homes, spreading misfortune like a rot. In Marie Laveau's household, a simple love potion turned to poison. For 3 days, the woman who drank it spoke only of visions of infinite darkness and suffering. On the fourth day, she expired in Marie's arms. The next day, Madame LaLaurie summoned Marie to her mansion. Her eyes were baggy, her hair rumpled. Over mint juleps, the madam explained she could no longer keep the wailing demon child. It had killed and eaten one of her slaves, Madame LaLaurie said with a yawn. And its endless cries were upsetting the neighbors. Marie was unsure if this was true. Yes, screams and cries emitted from the LaLaurie mansion. No one could deny that. But Marie suspected that Madame had merely taken her torture too far and killed someone herself. The cries coming from the second floor at this moment could be those of enslaved children. Marie had a feeling that, in her later years, Madame LaLaurie lacked the energy to stay up all night with the child. But Madame insisted she'd had enough of voodoo and needed Marie to take the child back, permanently. She led Marie to the nursery. Marie didn't want the blood on her hands, not directly. But she had no home to give the child either. When Madame left, Marie summoned her favorite snake, a boa constrictor. Walking in circles, counterclockwise, she wound the snake around the cradle. Then she bid Delphine goodbye. The next morning, Marie returned to pick up her snake. But instead of the familiar hissing, she heard a baby's coo. Its horns were stained with blood. The child had killed her snake, skinning it entirely, and using the skull as a rattle. They'd have to dispose of the demon another way. At midnight, Marie and Madame LaLaurie entered St. Louis Cemetery. Marie brought a shovel, Madame, the baby, and a small black hat box. It took less than 10 minutes to bury the thing alive. With that, the demonic wailing finally stopped. Marie felt the tension and the rot lift from her spirit and her household. The pair walked home, splitting up at Bourbon Street. But as Marie walked, she heard something. A subtle hiss. Marie ran the rest of the way home. After the burial, no one ever heard the devil baby of Bourbon Street cry again. But every so often, Marie saw a slithering flash in the corner of her eye. She pretended she didn't notice the large snake following her with its unmistakable bloody horns. In the late 1800s, residents of New Orleans fashioned devil baby dolls made from gourds, hanging them on the windows and setting them on their doorsteps. Supposedly, the devil baby dolls would save them from the real devil baby and his voodoo curse. However, by the early 20th century, a new legend had started. The very dolls that were supposed to protect their owners were themselves cursed. Up next, a woman summons the strength to fight back against Madame LaLaurie. Now, back to the story. The LaLaurie's marriage was not a happy one, and Madame Delphine took her marital frustrations out on the people enslaved in her house and on her plantation. Over time, Delphine grew more and more mentally unstable. Her moods shifted rapidly. Her own children and husband didn't want to be around her. Paranoia consumed her. She refused to feed the enslaved people working for her, believing that they would be more obedient if they were hungry. And the irony of cooking lavish meals for the LaLaurie dinner parties was not lost on the starving people they enslaved. One April night in 1834, Delphine was throwing another one of her marvelous parties. Champagne in hand, she toasted the elite of New Orleans. The very same people who gossiped about Delphine's habits behind her back smiled up at her and raised their glasses. Despite the charming company and party atmosphere, Delphine couldn't help but feel a sense of overwhelming doom. Excusing herself from her guests, she made her way to the kitchen. But as she rounded the corner, she saw small white hands snatching fried oysters from the silver platters prepared for the guests. But the oysters didn't go into Delphine's daughter's mouths. They went into their pockets. The girls looked up at their mother, feigning innocence. White hot rage welled up within Delphine. This wasn't the first time her daughters had stolen from her. This was supposed to be a happy night, but here were her two youngest daughters behaving like nasty, slave-loving thieves. She commanded them to turn out their pockets. and fried oysters spilled to the floor. The slaves were so hungry, the little girls cried, and there were so many oysters. Delphine stomped her heel over the food, grinding it into the floor. Then she smacked them, each across the face. Delphine berated them. That's only a taste of what you'd get if you fed my guests food to the slaves. Up their strength, and they'll murder the both of you in your beds. And me, too. Would you really kill your own mother? As they whimpered, she recalled that they were only children. The true criminal was the cook who allowed this to happen. This woman meant to start a rebellion. So Delphine made her daughters watch as she did the proper recourse and chained her enslaved cook to the stove. She told the cook she could expect to spend the rest of her life here, dragging the short chain between pantry and stove, cooking, but never eating. After the monstrous madam left the kitchen and went up to bed, the cook lay awake on the kitchen floor. She had spent 70 years working for cruel masters, but now she couldn't even walk the 10 steps across the kitchen to look out a window, as she felt cold kitchen tiles hard against her aging bones. The cook realized there was one freedom that Madame LaLaurie could never take from her. As dawn broke, she struck a match. She felt no fear as she watched the fire begin to catch, first on the firewood, then on the wooden beams of the kitchen walls themselves. The cook had lived in the LaLaurie mansion long enough to know several fates worse than death. On April 10th, 1834, the LaLaurie family woke to the scent of smoke. They ran screaming to salvage their favorite possessions from the fire. As the fire raged, the neighbors gathered outside. The small crowd soon became a mob as the neighbors realized the LaLauries were leaving their slaves to burn. Judge Canonge, a local magistrate, was woken by the noise. He ran downstairs and was accosted by infuriated neighbors who begged him to intervene. The judge politely asked Dr. LaLaurie to unlock the slave quarters so that neighbors could rescue his slaves. Dr. LaLaurie spat in the judge's face and ordered him to mind his own business. Judge Canonge gave the order to break down the door. Strong men battered the door of the slave quarters until it gave way. When it did so, they burst into a scene so horrific, it made the newspapers across America. Local newspaper, The Bee, reported the rescuers found, quote, seven slaves, more or less horribly mutilated, suspended by the neck, with their limbs stretched and torn from one extremity to the other, end quote. Rescuers lifted the torture victims on their shoulders and brought them out of the slave quarters, removing them to City Hall, where newspaper editors were invited to examine them. Reporters observed the dismal condition of the men and women laying moaning on the floor of City Hall. Every soul present was covered with scars from being beaten relentlessly with whips. Several wore iron collars with spikes facing inward, which would impale them if they laid down to sleep. All were painfully thin, with distended bellies, reminiscent of famine victims abroad. One poor man had a hole drilled into his skull. It wasn't recorded how long the hole had been there, but it was reported that it was infested with maggots, eating away at the living man's brain. When word of the LaLaurie's crime spread across the city, an angry mob approached to tear down what remained of the mansion. The LaLaurie mansion was ransacked from top to bottom. Delphine's actions had publicly exposed the well-known but little-discussed dark side of high society in New Orleans. And now, it could no longer be ignored. But Madame and Dr. LaLaurie were warned about the mob coming for them. By the time anyone went looking for them, the couple were on a steamship bound for Europe. Madame LaLaurie is believed to have lived out the rest of her life in Paris. And despite the fire and the mob, the house remained standing. If Madame LaLaurie had her way, death would have brought her eternal peace. But in the dark and mystical New Orleans, a murderess like Madame LaLaurie cannot expect death to bring release from pain. To this day, she remains chained to the scene of her crimes, as tightly as she once chained her emaciated 70-year-old cook to the stove. The balustrades and galleries she so adored in life have become the walls of her prison. If you pass by the mansion on a moonless night, you may see a light on in the attic and spot a woman's face peering longingly toward a street she will never walk again. Her husband, Dr. Leonard LaLaurie, has also been spotted in the house, always in full tails, smoking his telltale cigar, careless to his wife's atrocities. With these ghosts and others in the house, the mansion continued to be the site of tragedy, no matter how many new owners attempted to renovate it. The year was 1882, and 14-year-old Victoria couldn't be happier. Her parents had finally agreed to enroll her in the prestigious new conservatory for music and dancing, operated by an English woman whose tutelage attracted the finest families in New Orleans. The conservatory was housed in an old mansion in the French Quarter, located at 1140 Royal Street, one formerly owned by the notorious Madame LaLaurie. Victoria's brother, Gregor, had laughed at her for wanting to study violin at the LaLaurie mansion. "Everyone knows," he had said, "it's cursed, or haunted, or both." She fired back, reminding her brother that all the best families were sending their girls there. Would they be doing that if it was haunted? To ensure a positive first impression, Victoria arrived early to her assigned classroom and found she was the first one there. It was a cavernous space that had once been a dining room back when Madame Delphine LaLaurie lived there. All alone in this huge room, Victoria suddenly felt very small. It was darker than she expected. She had never been very comfortable alone ever since she was a small girl. To banish her nerves, she began to warm up her bow arm. In the big, empty room, Victoria thought the strange sound was an echo of her playing. But when she paused her bow, it continued. It seemed to be getting closer, but in the dim room, Victoria could see nothing. Her pulse began to race. She told herself, it must be somebody moving furniture in the next room. Or perhaps a dancer with squeaky shoes? She ran to the door to look, but there was nobody in the hall. And from that vantage point, she could clearly hear the noise was coming from behind her. Victoria struggled to contain her nerves. How could she be this unsettled by a little noise? The teacher would be there any minute. She was sure of it. Then, she heard the child. Victoria spun around and saw a small, thin black girl in a blue cotton dress facing the rear wall of the classroom. The girl's hair was tightly braided, and her arms moved methodically as she polished a silver pitcher. At first, Victoria was relieved. Perhaps this was the daughter of a teacher or of a servant in the school's kitchen? The girl cried softly as she worked. Of course, Victoria wanted to comfort the girl. She called out to her, but there was no reply. The child was engrossed in her chore and her tears. Victoria approached the little girl and reached out to tap her small shoulder. But the girl ran from Victoria, dashing across the room to a door in the rear of the classroom. The door opened onto a wrought iron fire escape, and the girl dashed up it at breakneck speed toward the roof. Victoria's heart caught in her throat. Still clutching her violin in one hand, Victoria chased the child up the stairs. As she reached the rooftop, Victoria saw the little girl at the very edge of the roof. "Wait!" she shouted. "It's not safe! Come back!" Victoria could hear the little girl weeping from across the rooftop. She carefully tiptoed toward her. She wanted to comfort her, but was wary of frightening her. Just as Victoria reached the corner of the roof, the child turned to face Victoria. Where her nose should be was only a bloody hollow. Bits of her orbital bones protruded from her forehead. One eye dangled grotesquely from her skull. She opened her arms and leaned forward to embrace Victoria. Victoria reflexively backed away from the bloody arms. Her foot slipped. Her arms flailed and her violin flew into the air as she tumbled from the rooftop. Victoria's parents were told she committed suicide out of anxiety about performing for her new, renowned teacher. But Gregor, Victoria's brother, knew better than to believe the coroner's report. He had heard the stories of people falling from the upper reaches of the LaLaurie mansion. He had heard of 12-year-old Leah, who one day made the mistake of yanking a snarl while brushing Madame LaLaurie's hair. He knew she was only one of the many ghosts who had been enslaved at the LaLaurie mansion. We can only guess at how many of the disturbing incidents at the school were Leah's work. Many could be pinned on the madam, taking out her eternal rage, or the doctor, turning a blind eye to tragedy, or the devil baby of Bourbon Street, bringing bad luck to all inhabitants. But we do know that each of the three times someone has tried to turn the LaLaurie mansion into a school, tragedy soon followed. In fact, each and every incarnation of the mansion as a commercial enterprise has failed in dramatic fashion, from criminal allegations to sudden bankruptcy. It's seen ruin as a bar, a furniture store, and an apartment complex. Shortly after buying the LaLaurie mansion in 2007, actor Nicolas Cage faced financial devastation and lost the property to foreclosure. Many say the mansion is cursed. After all, since Madame LaLaurie, no one has been able to maintain a residence in the mansion for more than 5 years. Perhaps it's best to let the mansion stand empty as a reminder of the culture of cruelty that lay beneath the glitz and glamour of antebellum New Orleans. Thanks again for tuning into Haunted Places. We'll be back Thursday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Haunted Places, as well as all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next week. Haunted Places was created by Max Cutler. It's a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Haunted Places was written by Devin Schwartz. I'm Greg Polson.